Ladies and gents, we're going to finish the book of Genesis today. And today I had a halachic question that was so difficult I wasn't sure about. I have to ask the class whether I gave the right answer. Should we hold a Chumash class on an Erev Yontif like this?
More so than Rish.
And I was, it's like Erev Yontif. Yeah. Tomorrow is Erev Yontif, right? What? So, I wasn't sure exactly.
Well, everyone that's here says yes. Those that aren't here, we don't know.
Turn to page 181. Let me just give you a little bit of a background. I know many of you know this in general, but just a little background. You know that Jacob was born second, and all his life, based on the advice of God, he wanted to be first, whatever that means. Whatever that means. And now that he's about to die, he's still concerned with people that are born second in their family, not only second, but second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, whatever, that they should also have the possibility to be considered the heirs of the spiritual legacy. So therefore, he has, Yosef is his beloved son, and Yosef has two children, and Ephraim and Manasseh. So let's turn now to page 181, sentence number 5. Yonah?
And now thy two sons who were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came unto thee into Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh.
So, Reuben and Shimon were his first two sons, and Reuben has had the title of firstborn, and he was also destined to be the high priest, and he was also destined to be king. So he had three titles that went along with his status of being the firstborn. Firstborn, king, and high priest. I mean, you can't ask for more. All of that was taken away from him because of what Yaakov felt was improper on Reuven's behavior after his mother died, whatever he did to Bilhah. It's an argument, whatever he did with Bilhah, either that he was intimate with her or just moved his mother's bed into Jacob's tent, whichever interpretation you want to go, all those three things were taken away from him for the time being. So, but nevertheless, at this time, Reuben and Shimon still had significant titles. So he's saying as follows, my grandchildren are as dear to me as my children. My grandchildren are as dear to me as my children. Let's see if we can understand what this means. What do you think that means in terms of your life? Yonah, what does that mean in terms of your life? My grandchildren are... Not your personal life, but your life as a Jewish lady. That you continue in what?
In the spiritual leadership of the people. Mm-hmm. Or in family. Continuation of
species. Right, continuity of species and things like that. You see how a lot of people feel that even though they have their own families, everyone feels a little lost. They want to belong to a tribe and to a nation and to a people and to a family and to a community. And we belong to all of that, and we still sometimes feel doubts and equivocations about our self-identity. And Yaakov was aware of that, so he's saying a statement not only to his grandchildren, but to all the future grandchildren of the Jewish people, which means that he's speaking to everyone in this room. And he's saying to you that you are as dear to me as my own two children. So therefore, if I ask you, if you can really absorb that on an experiential level, who is your grandfather? Jacob is one of your grandfathers at that time. And if you can live that way, then you always know where you are and what type of family you belong to and who you are. Then he serves as a prototypical spiritual grandfather with all the struggles, triumphs, and disappointments and openness that he experienced. If that's the case, then he also is asking you a certain question. What question did he ask all of his children at the end of his lifetime? What question did Jacob ask all his children? Which God do you believe in? Is there any doubt in your heart? And what did all the children answer him? What did they say? Shema Yisrael. So therefore, every time a Jewish person says Shema Yisrael, one of the people that they are addressing is their grandfather, Jacob. Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, which means my grandfather Jacob. Remember, there was a doubt in your heart if there's a continuity of species and in the heritage of the Jewish people. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echa. The God, the Eternal, our God, is one. So every time you say the Shema, it's like a personal dialogue with Jacob. That's one interpretation. And that's why he said that my grandchildren are as dear to me as my children. It's the only time something like this is ever said.
Very comforting.
Very, very comforting. Yeah? That frequently people feel, oh, I'm so far away from Matan Torah, from the time that the Torah was given, and there were so many great rabbis, and so there's so many years ago. The Torah portion here says just the opposite. No matter where you are in the history of time, you are as close to Jacob as you want to be. It's very comforting. And therefore, what you can do, you can have a personal relationship and a dialogue with Jacob, whatever you want, as if he would be your grandfather. Now, if he's your grandfather, then who else is in your lineage? Rachel and Abraham, they're all part of your family. And today an article just happened to come out that I wrote. There's a book that came out, I have it in my office. It's called Jung and the Monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, edited by Joel Rice Menuhin. And I wrote an article here called Jacob and Hero Israel about what we're talking about. So I'll make a few copies if anyone is interested. But basically what I said is in here. So ultimately, if someone asks you, who is your grandfather? You can have multiple grandfathers. And it doesn't only mean grandfather, it means a father image. A father image that you can struggle with. Your own father, as well as the paternal image of Jacob. So it's a beautiful sentence, that my grandchildren are as dear to me as my own children. Like, it's a statement for all generations for eternity. Basically, there's a big concept. There is a big concept in physics, and it's one of the most difficult concepts in science, is the concept of time. Time is one of the most difficult concepts to understand. I don't want to go into it right now, primarily because I don't understand it. But basically, what Jacob did, he bridged all time. The time that he lives and the time that you are now all together. It's only a matter of the swing of the pendulum. But it's pretty good if you can get yourself in that way of thinking. So that's what it says on page 181, that my grandchildren are as dear to me as my children. Any questions on that? Because that's a pretty important and powerful statement. He did that before.
Maybe that now the grandchildren didn't have any envy towards each other. Also the sons, after all these troubles, maybe now is the right time to utter the sentence.
Right. There's no envy at this point. You're right. It was before the bracha. Now, on Friday night, in most Jewish homes, parents give a bracha to their daughters and to their sons. And the bracha they give to their sons is what? You should be, may God be with you as Ephraim and Menashe, which means, what are you telling them? What is the secret that you're telling them, if they're able to pick this up? That their real father is not even you. You're just there in the pendulum of time as a link in the tradition, but your real father is Jacob. And therefore, if your real father is Jacob, when you say Shema Yisrael, then you can have an experiential experience, experiential event. And therefore, you say your father is, you are like Ephraim and Menashe. And what do you do with your daughters? And that's the same concept, that ultimately you are the biological mother, but the matriarchs are, your matriarchs are that. See, too many people say it and feel detached over time, that there's a tremendous gap of time. And what the Torah has done is taken the eternity of time and put it all together. Isn't that amazing that you can do that? Yes? No, I'll tell you why. He wanted also to communicate another message, which I want to get to in sentence 10, okay? But I'll get to that point in a moment. Let's do the next, Diana, sentence 10.
Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see. And he brought from there to him, and he kissed
them. So the first thing that Yaakov did with his grandchildren, this may sound a little trite to you, but it was important for Jacob, and not so trite as well either. He kissed them and he embraced them. And basically, what he's teaching us here, the pain that I had as a child, says Jacob, that I wasn't embraced by my father, I'm making sure that that pain will not be continued forever. And therefore, every time you give a bracha, every time you give a blessing, I want to give you a kiss and to give you a hug. And it's not like the Torah just says, oh, he kissed him and he hugged him. This is what Jacob, so to say, didn't have, because the Torah tells us his father liked Esau. So we never see his father touching him except when he gives him the bracha, whether he wants to check him out, whether he's really Jacob. So the second thing which we learned, when you give the bracha that Jacob is your father, you need to touch the person. Embrace them, kiss them, and hug them. Yes?
I'm sorry, just the beginning of the table. And I remember saying, I love my children as I love my grandchildren.
I love my grandchildren as much as I love my children, right? Leads into that, yes. Mystical experiences transcend time completely. So therefore, what Yaakov is also saying, which is important, we all have certain wounds in our life. We all would have preferred a mother with this type of attitude, a father with this type of attitude. Whatever the pain you had as a child or as a young adult, or even as a mature adult, the question is, what do you do with that pain? And Yaakov tells us, by Yishak, by Chabay, you take the pain and you transform it. That's why it lets us know that he kissed and hugged. For whatever you didn't have, now you have the opportunity to really do. Esther, sentence now 10, do number now, I'm going to skip something because I want to cover something. Sentence 20, Esther, on page 183.
And he blessed them that day, saying, by thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim, and Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. And Israel said,
okay, so basically, what is the bracha? The bracha, the blessing is, you should be like Ephraim and Manasseh, even though Manasseh was the firstborn. So the second message which Jacob is giving us, which is a monumental message, is that basically everyone can be the firstborn of a family. Everyone can carry the heir and carry the banner in their own talents. And that you should not do the famous fault of nepotism and favoritism, which only brings a lot of sibling rivalry. So, for example, in almost every family discussion which I have with patients upstairs, particularly if there's a critical situation and there's a question of respirator and DNR and all those things, so you have a discussion with one member of the family, the next day another member of the family comes and says, I want you to know that I'm the older sister. What does that mean, I'm the older sister? Disregard the hour you spend with the younger sister. She's 10 years younger. She comes from the East Coast. It doesn't matter. You know, I count. You laugh, but this is dealing with life and death, and this goes on all the time. Yes, Tom. Right. Right. No, not at all.
Or was it that he just wanted to come on the back?
Right.
I took the vote that I'm going to do it my favorite constitution.
No. Neither of those. The third one is he wants to show forever and ever that to be the carrier and bearer of the torch is can be for all the children in their own way. We skipped a sentence, but we maybe go on. Read sentence 19, Lillian.
And his father refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Howbeit his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations.
So in other words, both children, Manasseh and Ephraim, have the capability of being great people in their own way. That's what he wants to teach. Do you understand that, Donna? In other words, one person may develop later on in life, one child, one person may be involved in music, one person may be involved in athletics, whatever they're involved with, they each will have a talent, and that has to be nurtured. No, I don't think so. I think it's really, he wants to indicate that the spiritual legacy is open to everyone. It's usually that children develop in ways other than what their parents expected for them. That's the norm. So therefore, can you see your children developing and carry on even though they do different things? Most of the time, parents who are involved, let's say, in business, the children will then get involved in, you know, academics and humanities. Parents involved in humanities, children will get involved in the business aspect. You know, it's all this, just boom, click here. Right. You can go, I mean, how many parents have said, I worked my whole life, I have this whole business for you. You just have to walk in and you can sit down on the throne. Not interested. Not interested. I've worked for 30 years, so you can do this. Not interesting. Yes, Cheryl.
I want to know if Jacob didn't want to validate his own position because
he was the second one to do that. Yeah, that's what Donna's saying. Yeah, that's basically what Donna's. Whether he wanted to justify what he did with Esav, that's one way of looking at it. But he doesn't say that because he says, also your younger brother, both will be great people. Could be, but I see it more as recognizing the talents of each individual. Because, I mean, it's very funny that even though this is so clearly written in the Torah, most Jewish families, and that's the families I deal with mostly, put more emphasis on the firstborn, particularly if it's a male. And if the male is the secondborn, then, you know, it depends on their attitude towards women.
Yes.
With inheritance, right. Yeah, which is, so basically what the Torah is telling us, this is pathological. Even though later on in Deuteronomy we have a certain law about inheritance, but God forbid you should get the curse of inheriting more than your sibling. Did you understand what I said? Anytime there's a sibling and you inherit more, what will happen to you? Yeah, it's you're going to be lucky if you're going to be alive.
Right.
A bad situation. There will definitely be litigation and emotional distancing and all of that. Never, never take more. It will only be your disaster. That's basically it. Well, it's a very good question, because in Deuteronomy we do have a law like that. Does anyone know what the Midrash says on that? Why was that law written? Who did the Torah have in mind when the Torah was writing this law? Jacob's relationship to Rachel and Leah. His first two children, his first son is Reuben. And he had Reuben from Leah, which he didn't like as much as Rachel. So the Torah says, you have two wives, and you have children from both wives, and you really love Rachel, and you love Joseph and Benjamin, the double portion goes to Reuben. So what the Torah was saying, it was almost like helping Yaakov, that if you have two wives and multiple children from different wives, hopefully you will learn to love each wife accordingly. And if not, I want you to know that your firstborn, even if she comes from your less beloved wife, will still get double portion. So it's like the double, we don't live in such a society where a man is married to more than one wife.
At different times,
yes. At different times, right. But, I meant at the same time. But at the same time, if a man is married to more than one wife, there's a great likelihood that one will be loved a certain way and one will be loved a different way. And that different way is usually with less intensity and affect. So what the Torah says, if your firstborn is from your left, that firstborn will get a double portion.
It sort of is the question, though, of why is that everything was firstborn.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nowadays, no one does it like that. No one follows that law. I'm not sure how they do it in Israel. Does anyone know what happens in Israel? Inheritance? It's a good question. We'll think about it. Yes, Julie. So I guess they want you to know that the masculine should be mostly developed in the son, and the feminine should be mostly developed in the daughter. But it doesn't mean to the exclusion. Every son also should get the blessing of a Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah and Rivka and Sarah Rebecca. So ideally, one should get both. You're right. Absolutely. I agree with you. Masculine and feminine. But basically, if you ever want to bless your children and say, I want to bless you as Ephraim and Menashe, and like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, that would be fine. So everyone can inherit the masculine and feminine. That would be like what would be called, the word that came to my mind, that would be like a totality of one within you, a real union within you. Normally one looks for the union externally, but you're looking for the union internally. Let's turn now to page 188, sentence 33. Sentence 33 on page 188.
And when Jacob made an end of charging his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and expired and was gathered unto his people.
Okay, so basically, this is, I've always pointed this out, the way a person dies in a Torah, and he was gathered unto his people. It's a nice expression. And I want to explain that particular expression in a deeper way, because I think it's an important word, by Ye'asev, and he's gathered unto his people. Let's say you have an entity of, let's say, five people, and that's a family. And then another person enters that family circuit, and you have a sixth person. The sixth person not only joins the five, but what happens when the sixth person joins the five, it changes the five. In other words, the whole entity changes. It's not that one came, but a whole entity is changed. So basically, when a person dies, there are two metaphysical changes that take place. The family which is left behind has a different constituency because they don't have a father, they don't have a mother, and that's always a catalyst for the family to be different. And what usually takes place when a father or mother passes away in terms of the next few years, what usually takes place?
Families
drift away. They don't gather together for the holidays of Passover, Thanksgiving, Yom Kippur. The great family gathering when the maternal or paternal figure was there dissipates slowly over the years and new families emerge. That's one thing that takes place because a father figure always holds together, or we do things while father's alive. What other things take place when someone dies? Right, there's usually a godot b'mishpacha, but what happens to you, mostly? What changes?
You grow up.
Many changes take place within yourself, such as there are many people, for example, in Jewish circles, who, let's say, kept only ate kosher while father was alive, or had a kosher home. Father's not alive anymore, they don't eat kosher. Or in different area, what else, what other areas are involved?
Responsibility
and a sense of one other thing. There's a famous sentence in the Torah where Yosef was almost seduced by the wife of Potiphar. And what does the Medrash and Rashi say why he didn't succumb to that? He saw the image of his father. Yosef didn't know that his father was alive, but he saw the image of Jacob, and seeing the image of Jacob, said, I'm not going to do this. But when a parent dies, frequently what happens, you feel totally, totally liberated, and all the inhibitions of the image of your father or the image of your mother usually go away, and you do unusual things for the first 3 to 4 or 5 years. It usually takes place. Now, on the other side, on the metaphysical side, what takes place? Let's say other people are deceased. So you die, and you go wherever you go, the migration of souls. Your soul impacts the entity of the other souls that have been there, whatever that means. You know, sometimes they say, jokingly, what is this guy going to do? Oh, a card game is going to await him. You know, they think he's going from, there's a joke in Los Angeles, you belong to the Hillcrest Country Club, and then you go to Hillside, and, you know, Hillside. It's all on the hill, right? And they have a poker room in Hillcrest, a poker room there, and a poker room up there. I see that too many people belong to the rest here. But that's what it means by Yehasev El Amav, and you shall be gathered unto your people. Gathered, not only adding yourself, but ultimately changing that entity. And that's a very interesting thought. That not only are you there, but you act, your presence on a spiritual level changes where you're going. Yes, Esther.
Well, I think this is related, but my husband comes from a big family, and he's had 3 siblings passed away, and I've noticed my husband and his brothers sort of take over in the sense of the funeral, and it's a very touching thing. They were very bonded as children, and then they're really living their own lives, but when one of them still passes away, these brothers...
Each one is the paternal figure for one another. Now the next sentence, Marvin, sentence 1 on chapter 50, page 188.
Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him.
And look what happens. This is a pretty amazing sentence, and a lot of it's so simple, hardly anyone pays attention to it. But I always like to pay attention to what other people ignore. The first thing that Joseph does after his father dies is kiss him. What do you think motivated or prompted Joseph's kiss to a deceased body? Excuse me? Yeah, because they did do that when they met. Remember when they met, they did embrace. But, you know, Joseph was away from his father for more than 20 years. And even though he wanted to see the fulfillment of his dreams and wait for his brothers to do repentance, there was some gnawing guilt that Joseph felt. No matter how much right is to do logically and rationally, there still is this gnawing guilt, because guilt seems to be endemic to humanity. It's part and parcel of the fabric of who you are. And basically, what takes place in this hospital, any time that I am present at where there is a decedent, like the first thing that takes place, and I'm not judging this in a negative way, I'm saying this in a very positive way, the first thing that takes place is usually a kiss, and the statement that, what statement do people say?
I love you.
I love you. That usually takes place. A kiss, and that's because the fabric of life always produces guilt, healthy guilt, at times pathological, but mostly healthy guilt. And therefore, all the times I felt I loved you or didn't show it, there was this book that I just finished reading. I told you about it last time, Nils Lune by Jean's Peter Jacobson. And it describes certain scenes there. It's such a good novel. Is when this woman is having an affair, but she's still married to her husband, and they embrace, and they're intimate. So while they are embracing and intimate, she feels okay, but within her psyche, there are other thoughts as well. Then suddenly, unexpectedly, her husband dies. And she relives that embrace with a total different feeling, as if she's embracing her husband, but this time with full of guilt. When she had it that time, initially it wasn't that way. But now that her husband is gone, and then she goes back to her suitor and lover and say, look what you made me do. You made me live my life with guilt. So therefore, what Joseph does, and kiss him, is showing all future people that guilt is allowed and healthy, and even I, Joseph the righteous, who had to see the fruition of his dreams, I didn't do necessarily always what's right with my father. He died, I kissed him, I loved him, I lived a life that I was only human. And therefore, the Torah goes out of its way and says that Vayishat lo. Now, there's one other reason why Joseph kissed him, besides that. And that is because there's a relationship with the deceased even after the person has passed away. And I want to make sure everyone understands this. There was a new book written, it's called The Mitzvah of Mourning by Ann Brenner. Some of you may know it, some of you may not know it. It's in the bookstores around. And she talks about having a relationship with a deceased, and even reworking that relationship psychologically, even though that person is not there. And a lot of people do that. And what he's saying, by Yishaklo, no matter if you're alive or if you're dead, I can work through certain things. I can begin to understand your pathology on why you acted a certain way, and therefore, even though it was painful, I begin to be more aware of the interaction. And therefore, relationships exist with people, both physically in a person's life and psychically post-mortem. It's acceptance, but also working through the relationship.
Which means that you don't always accept them until you work through
them. Right. You're aware of all different things. Yes, Rabbi Mark.
Did you also say that it was a way of giving a blessing, saying your life is a blessing? Is this a way that will bless you?
You mean kissing one another?
Yeah.
That your life has been a blessing for me?
Yes. Yeah. Or just the notion that your life is a blessing. It's the last time I get to give this kind of blessing to you.
Mm-hmm.
Your life is a blessing.
Very nice. Yes, Bob?
Why can't you just accept the shot, so to speak, and just say it's, you know, it's bothering me, and then you die, you just don't mean, I don't say you're wrong, but it's necessary.
It's not necessary, but that's just the way my psyche works. Okay. I need to basically make the Torah come alive for me. But I understand people who take it differently, and I respect that also. Let me go on to sentence 15. Cheryl.
And when Joseph's brethren thought that their father was dead, they said, it may be that Joseph will hate us, but fully acquit us all the evil which we did unto him. And they sent him a message unto Joseph, saying, thy father did command before he died, saying, so shall you pay unto Joseph, forgive, I pray thee, now the transgression of thy brethren, and their sin, so that they did unto thee.
Now let me explain something to you, because many people ask me, there are many people who put a lot of emphasis on integrity and honesty. Most of those people who put a lot of emphasis on integrity and honesty have a type of personality that tends to be obsessive and compulsive. We learned from Joseph something different. Look what happened. The brothers are afraid that now that daddy has died, what will Joseph do to us? While daddy was alive, he's not going to do anything because it would hurt father.
Mm.
Once father is dead and he's still in power, wow, he can wipe us away in one slap. Mm. So Joseph is such a good person that after his father's death, he says the following sentence. And Rashi brings down that he said an intentional lie, that you're allowed to lie to change reality if it will bring a type of harmony and peacefulness to other people. And what was the lie? The lie was, in sentence, Avicha Tziva, in sentence 16, thy father did command before he died, saying, he's saying to his brother, that I should forgive you. Nowhere did his father say this, says Rashi. But ultimately what Joseph is saying, create a healing fiction for the sake of the family. Lie through your teeth. It doesn't matter. No one understands the difference between your world and someone else's world. Create a healing fiction so ultimately you will be forgiven. And you will not feel that I, Joseph, will take advantage because father is not alive. So there are these people who put tremendous emphasis on honesty and integrity. The Torah tells us that in the dynamics of family life, what is more important is to create a healing fiction. Yes?
I understand what you're saying, and that's perfect to me.
But it looks here from 2 Samuel 16 that the brothers were told to deliver that message to Joseph. Not that Joseph said that father,
the brothers
who were going to die, but it's the brothers who made up the lie.
And he bought it. He went along with it.
Yeah.
Right.
On which word, on which sentence?
The brothers
and they send a message, and they send a message saying, thy father's command. Yes, they lied.
They lied.
Yeah, yes. I'm sorry. They lied, and Joseph accepted it, and because he knew also. So he answered. What did he say in sentence number 19? Hatachad Elohimani. Am I in place of God? It's a beautiful sentence. You meant to do me evil, but God meant it for good. So I'm not going to judge you. So he accepted the lie. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yes, Donna. What? Well, not from the text.
No.
He may have. He may have. He may have said what's known on a deathbed confession, are you going to be nice to so-and-so and don't take revenge and don't be vindictive? He may have said that, but it's not recorded. But the but they lied in order to make sure that there was peace. Well, one second. So basically, it's important to know, while a lot of people put emphasis on total integrity, that there's no such thing as total integrity. Is that you see the world as you see the world as you want to present it to another person. And that is known as, can you present the world to another person in a healing fashion that will make them feel good? Now let's go to the last three words of the Torah of Genesis on page 191. Next, please. But Vayisem Baron Bemitzrayim. We'll read the whole sentence. Sentence 26. Yes. No, sentence 26. So the end of the book deals with the death of Jacob and the end of Joseph. Now there's something that you always know, but I like to point it out just because it's a beautiful thought. Whenever a story ends, in the seeds of the end is always the beginning of a new story. Because ultimately, stories never end. So therefore, who is put in an aron? Who is put in the aron, in the coffin?
Joseph.
Who is in the aron in the next page without looking? Who's in the Aron in the next page? Moshe. Moshe is in the Aron, not in that Aron, in a type of basket. So one person dies, Vayisem Baron Bemitzrayim, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt, and suddenly within that coffin, within that death, there's the transformation of being reborn. And that's how, that's so to say, how prophets and Moshe really develops. It's from this going from the abyss to climbing the top of the mountain. So therefore, what we learn from this, from Parshat Vayechi, which is a very fascinating parsha, but there's much more to say upon it, is basically, it's like, what do we do with life? And we take life as it is. We transform it. We kiss people, we say we hug them and we love them, partially because we did not have it, and therefore we create that, and hopefully it will be carried on and on and on, and someone dies and someone new is born, and after a Joseph you need a Moses, and all of that. And therefore, it's like the end of Genesis, it sounds like a death, but it's really the seeds of being reborn. Yes, please.
It also alerts you when it says that he got buried in Egypt because
right.
Everyone
else wanted to be taken back to their homeland
to be buried with their family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something different because Joseph continued that tradition as
a leader of the Jewish people. No, that's not true.
Saying he was buried in Egypt, right?
No, but look at this. No, but they put him in an Aron in Egypt, but he was carried to Israel.
He was carried off.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
As a matter of fact, does anyone know, is anyone here from Israel? Do you know where Joseph is buried? Does anyone?
No.
Exactly. Very good, Dr. Fields. I thought you know about Chinese history. I didn't know. You know. What's interesting, there's a hill in Nablus, and I went there once when I was there, and that's where Joseph is buried. And it's interesting, that's the land that may be given
back.
So it may be, it may become Palestinian, whatever that means, yes.
So, you say that if you and Fitch and Jerry would be fine to do the right thing,
you and Fitch
would
do
the right thing.
You and Fitch would do the right thing.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Something about the fiction can imply that it's phony. Joseph is by no means phony. He says clearly, you did evil against me.
Right, he says that. He says, "Atem chashav mai ra'ai, you meant evil against me."
Right. Right. Did that. That can't be denied. No, however, I'm not God.
And I'm not interpreting.
And God may say,
very good.
Evil.
Yeah.
He repeats that many times when he meets the brothers. He says, "But you did it evil, but there was a bigger plan."
Right. So the brothers have to hear it face to face.
Yeah.